The death toll now stands at 11, with more than 120 persons injured in the riots, looting, and fires of last night at the Bay. Affected areas are still reporting sniper attacks, and from almost any point in day, cloudy smoke from burning buildings can easily be seen. A curfew has been ordered for tonight. More on that shortly.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
I'm Lauren.
And I am Ken.
And this is Paradise After Dark.
Dark, 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 dark.
Paradise After Dark is an independent podcast covering true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
missing people,
and urban legends.
If you'd like to support our show, please subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/palmahawkmedia.
And also be sure to check out our website at paradiseafterdark.com.
On the website, you'll find links to all of our episodes, our mailing list, merch store, links to our social medias, and of course our Patreon.
Yes, and if you visit our website and happen to see the little tip jar on there, you can drop a couple coins in there and we'll give you a shout out on the show. Like tonight, we have a special shout out to someone I met at CrimeCon. It's Kelly from Cali. Or was that Kelly? Kelly?
Kelly, I got confused. Kelly from Cali?
Kelly from Cali. Say that five times real fast. So, Lauren, tonight we are traveling to the other coast of Florida, over into Miami and a little further south.
Right. Before Rodney King or Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, George Floyd, or any of the other African Americans who were killed by white police officers in the United States, sparking public outcry and even riots, there was Arthur McDuffie. And the protests, riots, and aftermath of this case was different from any other before or since, and we'll explain why and how in this story.
In the early morning hours of December 17, 1979, in Miami, Florida, a group of six Miami-Dade police officers began chasing a man on a black and orange 1973 Kawasaki Z1 motorcycle after one officer reported that the driver ran a stop sign. Now, according to the initial police report, the bike had led police on an eight-minute high-speed chase through residential streets at speeds of over 80 miles per hour. In some reports I read, almost 100 miles an hour. And the motorcycle then stops at an intersection. The driver was 33-year-old Arthur McDuffie, and he was an insurance salesman and a former Marine Corps policeman. McDuffie stopped his bike, faced his pursuers, and 4 days later, a comatose McDuffie died in a hospital. His skull cracked like an egg, according to the medical examiner. What the hell happened here?
Well, as dawn neared that morning, formal reports on the chase filtered in. "The subject failed to negotiate a left turn," wrote Sergeant Herbert Evans Jr. "The subject fell to the pavement, landing on his head," wrote Officer Charles Ververka. After this supposed crash, an officer claimed that McDuffie attempted to flee on foot. The officers caught him and a scuffle ensued in which McDuffie allegedly kicked Sergeant Ira Diggs, who wrote, "The subject was observed to be fighting violently." They claimed they had to subdue and restrain McDuffie, who weighed only 140 pounds, because he was combative and tried to run away.
Yeah, he wasn't a very large man. Fit, but not a large man. Now, while the officers were writing their reports and getting their story straight, McDuffie was being treated at Jackson Memorial Hospital, where, as we just mentioned, he died 4 days later. And the coroner's report concluded that he had suffered multiple skull fractures. One of them was 12 inches long. That's a massive, massive skull fracture.
Yeah.
Now, the medical examiner, Dr. Ronald Wright, said McDuffie's injuries were not consistent with a motorcycle crash. And I'm sure that this guy was well-seasoned enough to know the difference. And that if McDuffie had actually fallen off the motorcycle, as the police claimed, it did not make sense that its gauges would be broken. So the motorcycle gauges were obviously busted up, and Wright said that it seemed that he had been beaten to death. So the medical examiner felt that McDuffie's accident was not what caused his injuries. And the first of many articles on this case from the Miami Herald, printed on December 24, 1979, Dr. Wright told the newspaper that there are several blunt impacts that cannot be accounted for. Those blunt impacts are consistent with a type of injury that would be inflicted with possibly a police flashlight.
And the motorcycle. In the accident, the Kawasaki apparently fell on its left side. But in addition to damage that would likely have occurred as a result of the accident, every piece of glass and plastic on both sides of the machine were broken. That's what the doctor was talking about when he said that if this was a motorcycle accident, why are the mirrors broken?
Yeah, because I'm assuming that they take all aspects right into consideration.
So even the glass covers of the dashboard gauges were broken.
Which is
that's actually what he said was the gauges were broken. The glass
that's
on the
not
gauges.
Something that usually happens to all the gauges, usually one side or the other.
You can see where the machine has been beaten, Dr. Wright said. Tow truck driver Pascal Mojica said the motorcycle was in that condition in the middle of the street with a lot of blood in the street when police called him to tow it the morning after the incident. Charles McDuffie was the father of three small children. He was divorced but planning to remarry his ex-wife and take their honeymoon to Hawaii.
Kind of a fresh start.
He was an associate manager at Coastal State Life Insurance Company. He lived in a small house with one whole wall covered with plaques and certifications of his achievements over the years. In the Marine Corps, he was once named the most outstanding in his platoon. He was very intelligent. He would not fight with the police, his sister Dorothy told the Miami Herald. Superiors at the Miami-Dade Police Department sensed something was wrong, and internal affairs investigators were summoned.
So at this point, they feel like they need to get somebody to look into this.
Because something's not jiving correctly. I mean, the stories aren't adding up. So Sergeant Linda Saunders of the Miami-Dade Internal Affairs Office told the Miami Herald that the officers involved filed a use of force report on the incident. Among the officers listed was Sergeant Ira Diggs, who apparently first saw McDuffie run the stoplight at Northwest 54th Street and 27th Avenue at about 1:51 a.m. and began the chase. Other officers include Michael Watts, an officer who has been charged with brutal behavior in the past but never found guilty. Police and court records show that Watts had been accused of severely beating motorists stopped for traffic violations.
Red flag.
Sources said that a supervisor noted earlier that year that Watts had difficulty dealing with blacks. That is a direct quote from the Miami Herald.
Now, officers Charles Reverka and Alex Marrero were also identified in the use of force report. And among others at the scene were Officer Mark Meyer, William Hanlon, and Sergeant Herb Evans. Now, they arrived after the incident and reported it the next day to the internal review.
On Christmas Day, Charles Reverka, Alex Marrero, Michael Watts, and Sergeant Ira Dix were summoned to the headquarters and told they were suspended with pay effective the next day. On December 26th, Acting Metro PSD Director Bobby Jones announced that Charles Reverka, Alex Marrero, Michael Watts, and Sergeant Ira Diggs had been relieved of their duty in one of, quote, the most serious and intensive investigations in PSD history. Other police personnel may also be involved, Jones told the Miami Herald. A total of 10 or more officers were present when McDuffie was fatally hurt.
Yeah, they said it could have been 8, could have been 10. They weren't 100% certain who all was there, but internal affairs are going to figure it out. On December 26th, this is 9 days after the incident, Officer Reverka made a sworn statement on that he had lied in the initial report. Now, according to Reverka's statement, after McDuffie stopped, Reverka pulled him off of his motorcycle and McDuffie responded by taking a swing at him. Now, more officers arrived shortly afterward, and according to Reverka, 6 to 8 of them began beating McDuffie with nightsticks and heavy Kel Light flashlights. Reverka said he tried to pull McDuffie out of the quarrel but was unable to. So he's trying to make it sound like he tried to get him out of the scuffle.
Right. So 2 days later, on December 28th, 4 officers were arrested and charged with manslaughter in the beating death of Arthur McDuffie. The 4 charged with manslaughter were Charles Reverka, Michael Watts, Alex Marrero, and Sergeant Ira Diggs. Jones said that since 1973, the four accused of manslaughter had been cited in 47 citizen complaints and 13 internal affairs probes. Sergeant Herbert Evans Jr. was accused of being an accessory after the fact, and another officer, Ubaldo Del Toro, was accused of helping cover up what happened as well as fabricating evidence. Neither Evans nor Del Toro were involved in the stop. Okay, let's stop and take a look at who's actually in trouble here and what is actually happening, because this is even confusing to me. And I wrote this outline and did this research. So help me out here, Ken.
Okay. So one of the issues you got to stop and think is you got to figure out who was there, who saw what was happening, who was involved in the chase, who showed up on the scene, and who was. So you basically what internal affairs has to do is the who, what, when, where, and why, right? So they have to get all that basic set up. So now the investigators charged. So they get started and say, okay, we got to at least secure the main suspects in this case, and then they can branch out from there. So investigators charged that the four gentlemen involved that Lauren mentioned that were Charles Reverca, Michael Watts, Alex Marrero, and Ira Diggs. Basically, they charged them with beating McDuffie with a flashlight and billy clubs after what I said, the high-speed chase, and they clubbed his motorcycle to make death appear like a traffic accident,
right,
which we kind of mentioned, and the medical examiner picked up on that, hey, it doesn't seem like this the motorcycle was damaged like this in an accident.
And then, but Arthur McDuffie was beat with billy clubs and the Kel Light flashlights, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
So that was after the high-speed chase. So
yes.
After the chase, they get him, they beat him up, they beat the motorcycle. That's what the internal affairs is trying to put together at this point. Because remember, they're starting out the investigation, and this is what they've already come to the conclusion of, and this is what they're going to start investigating. And Bobby Jones says, it was no accident. It appears the accident was subterfuge to cover up of what actually happened.
Okay. All right. All the charges were filed in circuit court on information supplied by Captain Marshall Frank of the Police Department Homicide Division. On the basis of Captain Frank's investigation, four other officers were suspended with pay but faced no criminal charges. In the initial affidavit filed with Circuit Judge Richard Fuller, Captain Frank said to the New York Times in an article published on December 29, 1979, in the process of arresting and handcuffing him, McDuffie's helmet was removed and he was thrown to the ground. Officer Ira Diggs, Michael Watts, William Hanlon, and Alex Marrero proceeded to strike McDuffie in and around the head and chest with flashlights and nightsticks no less than five times.
No less than five times is a pretty good beating.
During this time, the defendants used their flashlights and nightsticks to repeatedly strike the motorcycle upon which McDuffie had been riding, and which, at the time he was initially apprehended, was undamaged.
Yeah, remember, he stepped off the motorcycle and basically faced him. He was done.
He never crashed.
He stopped.
At the instruction of Sergeant Herb Evans, the defendants subsequently reported that the injuries to McDuffie and the damage to the motorcycle were the result of a motorcycle accident. There was no accident.
Yeah, all the evidence is pointing to that direction.
Officer William Hanlon would later testify that he had choked McDuffie to the ground with his nightstick before he managed to handcuff him. After McDuffie was restrained, Officer Alex Marrero struck McDuffie in the head with his Kel Light flashlight at least three times. It was very strong and very powerful blows. His entire face was covered with blood. Hanlon added he was the officer who had driven over McDuffie's motorcycle. Hanlon also gouged the pavement with a tire iron to simulate skid marks and threw McDuffie's watch into the gutter. A patrol car had been used to deliberately run over the motorcycle to break its gauges and make it seem as if McDuffie had crashed.
So at this point, we can determine that the medical examiner was correct, stating that the motorcycle was not really damaged to this effect, or this extreme, if you will, during the accident. So we already know that that is fact.
And it seems like they went all out to cover this up and make it look like they almost went too far. They if you got a guy out there
with a tire iron trying to make scuffs in the pavement, that's now you're just going a little to the extreme.
So Officer Mark Meyer testified the high-speed chase had slowed to 25 miles per hour when McDuffie shouted, "I give up," and stopped. Meyer said that between 3 and 8 officers then surrounded McDuffie, pulled off his helmet, and proceeded to beat him with nightsticks. He said that the officers struck him at least twice. By the end of the struggle, the officers had, in the words of medical examiner Dr. Ronald Wright, cracked McDuffie's skull, quote, like an egg, using long, heavy, blunt objects. This was a melee, end quote.
Yeah, I can understand you get in a situation, you're in a high-speed chase. The officer that witnessed whatever it was that he was pulling over for, running the red light, and you get other officers involved, they're very charged, the adrenaline's flowing, it's a very hyped-up situation. But obviously, it went a little too far. Let's take a quick break from this. So, before we progress and start talking about the trial and what transpired to cause the situation we're going to discuss in a little bit, I want to kind of talk about these police officers as individuals. So, remember, these guys are individuals who made their own decisions. They don't represent the police force as a whole. They're not the police. They're just police officers. So they work for the police. You understand what I'm saying, Lauren? Am I making sense?
And I think it's important to differentiate the individuals from the police force as a whole in these situations, because this is not the first or the last situation where an African American has been killed by white police officers. I mean, it's so touchy. It's so hard to walk that line. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
But in this case, I think it's important to, like I just said, differentiate that these individuals made these choices, did what they did, and now they're being prosecuted for it.
Yeah. Evil gets into every facet of the community. I mean, if you look, you got John Wayne Gacy. He was a clown that went to parties, people's parties. In some cases, there were even children's parties he was at.
Yeah.
What was the other one we discussed before? We talked about BTK.
Yeah.
He worked for some alarm company. He was selling alarms. He would go into people's houses and give them estimates.
Yeah.
So these evil people.
Ted Bundy was a suicide hotline operator.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. So evil can creep within.
I think evil makes its way into everywhere.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. So on February 1st, 1980, Alex Marrero's charges were up to manslaughter. Now, Marrero was 25 at the time, and he was a Cuban refugee. And supporters formed a committee and distributed 200,000 leaflets saying Marrero was being railroaded as, quote, the perfect scapegoat because he was Latin. As an example, Ververka testified, quote, I heard Officer Marrero yell something to the effect like, easy, one at a time. I mean, because everyone was swinging, fighting, and hitting, and apparently they were hitting, you know, the other officers as well as the victim. So he's starting to place blame already on Marrero. Now, about then, the bloodied McDuffie was handcuffed by Hanlon. This is about the time that he was being beaten with all the other officers. They're coming in, they're hitting him. Which Ververka is saying that Marrero was kind of one that sort of pushed this a little bit. Hanlon said, quote, and that's where I saw Marrero outstanding over top of the subject. He said Marrero gripped his kel light like a baseball bat and crashed it into McDuffie's head. Quote, I recall at least 3 times. It was very strong. It was very powerful blows. His entire face was covered with blood. And Hanlon and Marrero discussed how much pressure it takes to break a man's leg. Hanlon said, Marrero took the nightstick from my hands and began beating him in the legs.
The 8 officers involved were all dismissed from the force, and 5 of them would go on to stand trial in March of 1980 on various charges. Ira Diggs, manslaughter, aggravated battery, tampering with evidence, being an accessory after the fact. Herbert Evans, tampering with evidence and being an accessory after the facts. Alex Marrero, second-degree murder and aggravated battery. Ubaldo Del Toro, tampering with evidence and being an accessory after the fact. And Michael Watts, manslaughter and aggravated battery.
I have a real hard time with the manslaughter charges, but I digress. Now, three of the former officers were granted immunity for testifying against the others. I'm not a fan of immunity in situations, and I'll explain why towards the end of this episode. Now, William Hanlon, he was immunized for his testimony, along with Mark Meyer and Charles Verwerka.
But before the trial even started, the rumblings of what was to come began. Many black residents said the officers who were charged with manslaughter should have been charged with murder.
Agreed.
The people just concluded that if the situation were reversed, the charges would be murdered, said Robert Sims, executive director of the County Community Relations Board. The prisons are full of blacks serving more time for less. Other black leaders said the officers wouldn't be punished severely enough under the manslaughter charges. But Assistant State Attorney Hank Adorno defended the charges, saying they are appropriate under the circumstances and that he has, quote, other legal reasons that I'm not going to discuss. The lead prosecutor assigned to the case was Janet Reno, later U.S. Attorney General during the Clinton presidency.
Most people listen to this know who Janet Reno is. She's kind of a bulldog. She's tough, which was very surprising that the community really didn't really like her in this case. But it will be understood as to why later. Now, Reno had stated that she would seek the maximum sentence for any of the officers that were convicted of manslaughter. Reno's comments came after a meeting with the Black Lawyers Association, who, you know, they were concerned that the manslaughter charges would be too light. And Reno said the charge of manslaughter was appropriate based on the evidence and the law. And if anyone had any other evidence or legal argument to indicate the other charges should be filed, they should come forward. In other words, she's saying, hey, if you don't think the manslaughter charges are good enough, you need to come tell us why and what do you have. So later that same day, a group of approximately 40 protesters marched in front of the Metro Justice Building calling for justice. So they're going to start this assembly and they're going to start the protest. And black leader Marvin Dunn, who organized this march, said he had spoken to Reno and told her that the manslaughter charges just weren't harsh enough. I'm going to kind of agree on his side on this. You know, go for the max charges as you can. And this was only one of several marches in protest in Miami leading up to the trial of these officers.
Because of the volatile atmosphere in Miami, which presiding judge Lenore Carrero Nesbitt had termed a, quote, time bomb, the trial was actually shifted to Tampa, Florida. Jury selection began on March 31st, 1980.
So Miami to Tampa is about how far? Are we looking at 5 hours?
Probably. You'd have to come across the state and then go north.
So we're going to go 5 hours
away. 5 hours away, yeah.
And at trial, so now we're at the trial. The defense claimed that the police were violently attacked by McDuffie, an ex-Marine that they called a karate expert, and the only necessary force was used to subdue him. Remember, they talked about some of the officers said that he was beaten heavily with their flashlights. And the chief assistant state attorney, Hank Adorno, disagreed. Quote, somebody's beat this man's brains in, unquote.
I don't think that's ever considered the necessary force to subdue someone.
Exactly.
Beating someone's brains in.
That's one of the problems. Now you've escalated this beyond manslaughter charges, in my opinion. Now, the defense attacked the credibility of the three witnesses, Verwerka, Meyer, and Hanlon, who had been immunized in exchange for the testimony, describing them as liars. So now the defense is going to say, hey, these guys that you have as state's witnesses, yeah, their testimony is not.
They're liars.
Exactly. They're lying to you. Now, the three key witnesses that were immunized, said Adorno, they've gotten a free ride, a free ticket. There's no question that an immunized witness has reasons to falsify. He's protecting himself. Adorno reminded jurors of a medical examiner's testimony that McDuffie's head was crushed by 6 blows, one of them leaving a 12-inch fracture. Quote, somebody's beat this man's brains in. Somebody beat McDuffie in the head with a nightstick or baton. Hard, real hard, end quote, said Adorno. Now, lawyer Ed O'Donnell, now he's the one representing Marrero, who, remember, was the only officer charged with second-degree murder, insisted the case against the four white former officers was filled with lies, capping a slipshod and vile investigation. Now, he told jurors that the prosecutors waved pictures of Arthur McDuffie's cracked skull before them in an attempt to get you to act like crazed bulls and charge a verdict they want. Marrero had taken the stand and admitted he hit McDuffie with his nightstick as hard as he could 3 to 6 times, but said McDuffie was resisting. But despite Marrero's testimony, on May 17, 1980, the all-male, all-white jury deliberated for 2 hours and 40 minutes before acquitting all four ex-officers on all charges. Quote, "In God's eyes, they're all guilty. God will take care of them," wailed Eula Bell McDuffie. Now, she's the mother of Arthur McDuffie, and she screamed this as she was led from the courtroom. "I knew God's justice would take care of my boy," cried Julia Marrero, the mother of Alex Marrero, who, as we mentioned before, faced the stiffest charges of second-degree murder. "He is innocent," she sobbed, clutching rosary beads. So now it's getting intense because we don't really know what's going on in this trial.
All of these officers who had charges brought up against them for the death of Arthur McDuffie have been acquitted.
Yeah, in a span of 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Right.
Which so, I find to be a bit disturbing in itself. So can we just take a quick break for a second?
Yep.
Let's do that. Okay, so let's just discuss this for a quick little second. There's something I want to bring up because Carhart, who was the defense lawyer for Evans, he actually blamed the prosecution for basically giving immunity to the other officers. He feels like the jury could have been persuaded a little better in the prosecution's favor had they allowed the other officers who they felt like were more involved be convicted in this case. So I think the jury thought, okay, look, I don't think the four guys that you have on trial here were the main involved. The ones with immunity are more involved. He maintained that the jurors were very well persuaded and that there was reasonable doubt as to whether the right men had been put on trial. I mean, he did maintain that the state charged too many police officers in an effort to make this big splash, and they wound up convicting no one, you know, and that's a dangerous situation that prosecutors find themselves in.
So. Well, a few hours after the verdict, the 1980 Miami riots broke out. Now, you can Google 1980 Miami riots. There's a Wikipedia page about it.
There's also a documentary about this case called Liberty Burning.
Yes.
Check that out.
So there was violence in several sections of Miami, and at least 3 people were killed. 23 people were taken to Jackson Memorial Hospital, where spokesman Mike Marquez said several were in, quote, very critical condition.
Now, mind you, the 3 people that were killed was early on in this situation.
Police said 50 to 60 persons had been arrested on a variety of charges. Cars were overturned and burned. Windows were shot out. There were reports of fire and looting. Approximately 5,000 people attended a protest at the downtown Miami Metro Justice Building.
Keep in mind, the trial happened in Tampa.
A group of protesters occupied the first floor of the downtown Metro Justice Building for several hours until police and reinforcements regained control of the building just before midnight. While the building was being occupied, cars nearby were burned and more windows were shot out.
Just like a riot. I mean, just picture the violence.
This is all right after, this is the day of the verdict.
Exactly. So that the verdict happens in Tampa. That's what I mentioned earlier. And because of the McDuffie, I mean, this guy was a part of the community. They're angry.
A large-scale rock and bottle throwing incident broke out in a 6-block area of a predominantly black Liberty City section of Miami. By 6 p.m. that night, the protest had turned into a riot. While driving home after a day of fishing, 3 white men were dragged from their car and beaten to death in Northwest Miami. Another white man driving home from work that night was ambushed by a stone-throwing mob. He drove into a wall while trying to get away, and the crowd set his car on fire, burning him to death inside.
That kind of reminds me of the Rodney King riot, where they took that gentleman out of the semi. They took the guy out of the semi and or the rig, and they beat him violently.
The driver of a car with three white people lost control after it was surrounded and stoned. After the car struck and injured two black pedestrians, the occupants were pulled out and beaten. One of the men in the car would die from his injuries 26 days later. In another incident, a black man who had driven into a convenience store was shot in the chest with a shotgun by someone in a passing pickup truck while his family watched.
Awful.
Governor Bob Graham ordered 500 National Guard troops into Miami to help state and local law enforcement officers cope with the violence, but despite his doubling their numbers the next day, the riot continued. 12 more people were killed and 165 injured as violence spread to the Black Grove, Overton, Liberty City, and Brownville sections of Miami. In addition, fires, burglaries, and looting increased, with police reluctant to enter some of the areas for fear of sniper fire. And here we have a clip of what Arthur McDuffie's mother had to say about what was happening.
Mrs. Yolanda McDuffie, what are your feelings in the wake of the incidents of the past 24 hours? How do you feel? What would you like to say to the people of Miami?
Well, I don't feel very bad about myself. I think that she could have. And let's get together and try to talk to them and I'll say it for me. And they say people don't hate people. But they do something about what they are around anybody. Because this ain't gonna sit on the table. And some of them, I think this will come out because too many people getting killed. But I don't believe it. I don't believe in killing everybody. But it's going too far, and I ask these people to pray. But there's in my eyes, the goodness, and look to God, and that's what we need to look to. Because if there's been no God in them, this wouldn't even happen. It wouldn't happen. They don't have no God in the Bible. And the Bible is doing some terrible things. And just need to look to God. That's what I would like to say to the community people.
She's very calm for someone who has lost her child.
Right. Well, she didn't just lose her child. I mean, it had been months and now the trial's over. But what she has to say, I think, is so important to actually stop and listen. This is the mother of the victim. The victim gets lost in these situations.
Yes.
You know, it turns political. It turns black against white. It turns police against citizens. But in reality, this was a human being who was murdered, who had a family. He had children. He was getting married, planning a wedding and a trip to Hawaii. He had a mother. You know, I think it's important to, in these situations, which we've had these situations happen in our country, and it's almost like it's escalating more and more in the last 5, 7, 10 years, always just try to remember the victim.
Exactly. And I think that's what gets lost here, and it gets crazy. And I think that's where she was reaching out saying, look, let's stop this. We're doing this to ourselves. We're hurting ourselves because of what happened to one of us. You know, what happened to a member of this community.
Right.
And now this community is falling apart because of what these people have done to us. So the last thing we need to do is basically turn on each other. So let's keep in mind that we're a community and let's get past this and move on. I think that's what she was really trying to say.
Well, by the third day, the violence had declined and the city imposed a curfew from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m., coupled with a temporary ban on the sale of firearms and liquor.
I think that's standard protocol.
Governor Graham sent in 2,500 National Guardsmen in addition to the 1,000 already in the city. Local police barricaded parts of Coconut Grove to warn motorists away from the area, as drivers had reported having rocks thrown at them. The city basically came to a standstill. Reports of sniper fire at freeway drivers also stopped traffic until the military could restore order.
That's a scary situation.
In total, 18 people were killed over the 3 days of rioting, while 370 people, some of them children, were hurt, and 787 people were arrested. Property destruction exceeded $100 million, and that's in 1980.
Yeah, that's about four times that now, that number.
The federal government declared Miami a disaster area and authorized the release of funds to allow the city to rebuild. The Miami Fraternal Order of Police had threatened a walkout unless the officers were reinstated. The following day, the officers who had been acquitted were reinstated to their jobs.
I find that to be a bit disturbing. Well, as we mentioned in the beginning, the protesting and riots after the acquittal of the officers who killed Arthur McDuffie was different than the others before, like Lauren mentioned earlier, I mean, or since, for that matter.
Miami's 1980 race riot was sparked by, quote, intense hatred and gave rise to unprecedented killing of whites by blacks, according to a report issued to coincide with the first anniversary of the violence.
Yeah, the riot started and progressed differently than those of the 1960s, and Miami's rioters came from a much more law-abiding segment of the community.
The riot started and progressed differently than those of the 1960s, and Miami rioters came from a much more law-abiding segment of the community, the report concluded. This report, written by Florida International University psychology professor and black community spokesman Marvin Dunn and New York journalism teacher Bruce Porter, was released on the one-year anniversary of the carnage. The report concluded that unlike prior riots in 1967 and 1968, the, quote, one purpose of the riot was beating and killing whites, unquote.
Yeah, I read in a few different spots. There were so many people that were in the community that were just frightened for the community itself. It was like, hey, you know, we've been trying to build this community up. We've come a long way. We can't let this tear us down. And what they were fearful of was taking this too far to where the community would go to a point where no one would want to come there. No one would have shot there. No one would want to be there and basically just kill the businesses in this community. And the folks in the community were going to suffer.
So let's talk about the aftermath. Days after the verdict, the U.S. Justice Department said it would seek indictments of the policemen for federal civil rights violations. On July 28, 1980, a federal grand jury indicted Charles Vavrka, despite his having received immunity from the original charges filed by the state during the first trial. It was his testimony at the original trial where he admitted to beating McDuffie as hard as he could with a flashlight that secured this federal indictment. Vavrka was charged with violating McDuffie's civil rights by filing false criminal charges, conspiring to violate his civil rights, conspiring to falsify reports, and being an accessory after the beating. Vavrka's lawyer protested the indictment as double jeopardy and a violation of his client's immunity.
Yeah, keep in mind, he was one of the few that were immunized.
Federal officers said the charges were valid because they are different than those originally lodged against Vavrka by the state of Florida.
Yeah, these are federal charges. They're different, right?
Yes. Well, and they're even different charges. They're not charging him with murder or manslaughter or anything. They're charging him with conspiracy to violate McDuffie's civil rights, conspiracy to falsify reports, and being an accessory after a beating.
So the defense lawyer was somewhat correct in stating that, hey, I think you got the wrong guys on trial here. I think if you would have brought these other officers in on trial or onto this trial, they may have gotten a conviction to the jury.
Vervirka normally would have been tried in Miami, but racial tensions there remained high. So the trial was moved to Atlanta. But that city, too, was troubled, especially by the slayings and disappearances of 15 black children at that time. Now, this was during the time of the Atlanta child murders.
Oh, yeah.
The series of murders committed in Atlanta between July 1979 and May 1981. Now, over a one-year period, at least 28 children, adolescents, and adults were killed.
That was a scary time in Atlanta.
Wayne Williams, an Atlanta native who was 23 years old at the time of the last murder, was arrested, tried, and convicted of two of the adult murders and sentenced to two consecutive life terms. Police subsequently have attributed a number of the child murders to Williams, although he has not been charged in any of those cases. And Williams himself maintains his innocence, although the killings ceased after his arrest.
Funny how that works.
So they moved this federal trial to Atlanta as the Atlanta child killings are happening. So Atlanta might not have been the best choice. So
what do you do?
Vervirka's trial was then shifted to New Orleans. But when four black people were killed in a police shootout, Mayor Ernest Monal asked that the trial be moved again. It then traveled west to San Antonio, where, to no surprise, some city leaders were not thrilled either.
Well, if you just – can we just talk about this for a quick second? If you think about it, they all know what happened in Miami at this point.
Yeah, they're playing hot potato.
Exactly.
They don't – like, nobody wants this happening in their city.
Because they're scared. But what they forgot was the trial occurred in Tampa. And the riots happened in Miami. So,
right.
But you could have this situation escalated by having this trial here. So it's totally understandable why they were fearful.
Well, in San Antonio, two local black leaders personally protested to Chief U.S. District Judge William Sessions. I asked Sessions to not accept the trial in San Antonio, said City Councilman Joe Webb. There is a great potential that this trial will disrupt the generally good relations between races in San Antonio. The racial climate in San Antonio is, by and large, good, added Charles Hudspeth, president of the local chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. We are getting along fine, and we don't need to bring in problems from Florida to get this all riled up. This has the potential of turning San Antonio into another Miami.
Why everybody gotta be scared of Florida?
However, San Antonio Mayor Lila Cockrell said she feels her city is mature enough to take on the trial in stride. I wasn't overjoyed at getting the trial here, but it's something we can handle. U.S. District Judge William Sessions set the case for trial in San Antonio. U.S. District Judge William Sessions set the case for trial in San Antonio. U.S. District Judge William Hoveler of Miami was to preside.
Now, on December 17, 1980, Vervirka was acquitted again in the week-long trial after the jury deliberated for more than 16 hours. So now, at least the jury spent a little more time than the original one did to basically acquit Vervirka. Now, minor incidents of violence were reported in Miami after the verdict was announced. So there were little stirs here and there. Now, November 17, 1981, Dade County commissioners agreed to a $1.1 million settlement with McDuffie's family in exchange for their dropping of a $25 million lawsuit that they had filed against the county. Now, of that amount, the family's legal team received $483,833, while McDuffie's two children each received $202,500, and his mother received $67,500. And honestly, I kind of, when you look at those numbers, they just don't seem to add up correctly to me. It seems like the legal team made off a lot better than the family.
Well, that's kind of how it works in civil litigation cases.
Yeah, you know, and something I want to bring up here to kind of close out this case a little bit, Lawrence. I mean, is there anything else you want to add? I just want to kind of close this out. With, to me, the part that I find frustrating here is, again, I think Arthur McDuffie, the victim, got lost in the riots. I think he got lost in the trial. You know, the reason they were all there and the reason this is all happening was Arthur McDuffie had borrowed his cousin's motorcycle. He went on a ride. And yeah, he was probably speeding for the most part. Maybe he did run a stop sign. Maybe he didn't, stop light, whatever. But I think we forget that there's a victim in this case. And I think that as a community, as a whole, I think that Miami just kind of lost control. And there was a lot of people within the community. If you read into some of these cases and look at some of the original news reports, the community was pretty devastated at this point. I mean, and not necessarily by the trial itself, but by community members themselves. And I think that's where a lot of the problem lies in some of these situations, is I think people get angry and they get heated to the point where the victim just loses. You know, the victim is lost, I should say, rather, in the situation. You understand what I'm saying?
Yep.
So is there anything else you want to add to this case?
No.
All right. Well, I guess that's going to be it for tonight.
All right. Again, if you'd like to support the show, please consider subscribing to our Patreon.
Yeah, it's patreon.com/Pommelhawk Media. And be sure to also check out our website for links to our social media, our merch store, and anything else that happens to, say, Paradise After Dark. We'll be happy to, you know, take you on.
Please make sure to subscribe to the show on whatever platform you're listening on and rate and review. This really helps us branch out and reach a wider audience.
It really does go a long way to help out the show. So nothing else, just give us a, just give it a quick little 5-star rating. That's fine. And as always, everyone, thank you very much for listening
to Paradise After Dark.
Dark, 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 dark.